and welcome back. Thank you for joining us for another edition of the Daily Dots. We were just tying up a little conversation about the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Interesting development there with the and I do think it is applicable to markets, because obviously that's going to have an impact on oil. It seemed to be kind of some preliminary deals that we've reached agreement on a ceasefire. Only problem is Israel, who's sort of important in this discussion. They disagree.
I had a tweet showing you keep hearing the Qataris or the Egyptians say oh, this is going great. And then you check in with the actual two parties that are at war with each other. And they keep saying no. In this case, it was finally one side is like, no, we're in for this, for the deal. And the other side's like, no, thanks.
You know, what's funny to me, this has been an aspect of it that I think is really funny, especially in light of the people on the college campuses, you know, Israel's locked them in. You're like, they share a border with Egypt. You know what I mean? Palestine does. So, and more people go across the border, even to this day, in and out of both, you know, on the Israeli side of the border than do on the Egyptian side of the border. It's this whole Israel's an occupied force. And you're like, I get where the comment comes, but realistically and logistically, no more so than Egypt.
Well, and to be fair, it's not just that, because even if you don't have a direct border with them, but you pretend to be a great champion of theirs, like many of countries in the Arab world, but then they don't really take them in.
Yeah, they don't do anything to help.
Like airdrop you a bag of money, but please don't come over here.
No, they're supportive when they're killing Jews. And that may sound really rough, but I mean, it's another big piece of, and I don't want to tick people off. I there's right and wrong, and I'm not saying that. And my last name's Abraham. I'm obviously very sympathetic to the Jewish side of it. One of the other things that I do think is really unfortunate on the Palestinian side is the way that they've been used as proxies for every other Middle Eastern country with money, has really taken advantage of them.
It kind of reminds you of I don't know how else to say it other than poverty pimps.
Yeah.
In the U.S. where,
yeah.
Let's keep where you could argue it kind of pays to keep people down enough to where they need you, where they're only source of support is from you, so that they always support you and things like that.
Cause yeah,
it's a kind of a similar setup.
Yeah. It's one of the other things that makes the reaction on the college campuses so hard to swallow though. And also, it's just disheartening. And I guess watching stupid young people come to the wrong conclusions shouldn't be surprising to anybody, but it's the malicious and violent overtones to it. Flat out anti-Semitic stuff that is very troubling. But I think one of the other most troubling things to me is just how far off everybody is. We're, you know, and truthfully, I think you see it on both sides where you go, hey guys, this is a human tragedy. Right? This is a human tragedy, centuries in the making, thousands of years, millennia in the making. And you're going to sound as ridiculous as if you jumped in the middle of a family fight of your in-laws. Right? Meaning they both, they're an occupying force. Quit using the word occupy. You're an idiot if you use it. Both of those people have claims on that land that go back thousands of years. And they have been battling over it for thousands of years. Right? They're the occupier. Shut up. You don't even know what an occupier is. Well, 1948. How about 48? Right? You're little. 1948 isn't quite going back far enough. Anyway, that's my rant on that. And you and I have talked about this a lot, and I know that you agree. I think one of the most frustrating things about it, and what's funny is I think you see it playing out in a lot of other cultural debates in our country, which is we're not even debating the right thing.
Right, exactly.
Who's right? No one's right. And everybody loses, guys. That's what blood feuds are. Right? Now, who's right in the recent salvo and all that kind of stuff? Look, I've got strong feelings on that. I think that Hamas declared war on October 7th. At the same time, a lot of people that have nothing to do with Hamas and that hate Hamas and that are under their thumb are going to be the ones paying in blood for that choice. Right, and so even those who are the most ardent defenders of the Israeli side, which I traditionally tend to be, also need to understand the horrific cost and the I don't want to use the word atrocity because it implies illegality. And I really don't think the Israel, from my perspective up until this point, I don't really see anything illegal going on. But yeah, it's just so much more complex. Anyway, this is not called Know Your Geopolitical Risk Radio. It is called Know Your Risk Radio. So getting to the Daily Dots, give us a rundown. But that is geopolitical news that I think does have an impact on the markets. If things got a little bit rocky there, judging by, and guys, if you, I don't want to give it away, but Chase is going to want to talk, drum roll, he's going to want to talk construction jobs today. Yeah. Shocker. Okay. So let's get a rundown though, before we get into some of that data. But what I was going to say is I think the reason we got to keep an eye on this, obviously it's a human interest story and it's a humanitarian story, but with some of the quote unquote weakness, and I don't want to overstate it, but I think you're seeing some cracks, if you will, in the economic picture that, or what appear to be fractures that could develop into quote unquote cracks, maybe some potential weakness.
Well phrased. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons we need to keep an eye out on the Middle East is that, a pop in oil, I think could turn them into legitimate cracks. That's definitely a threat to keep an eye on. So anyway,
and it's notable that, you know, we had headlines of like, oh, here comes the peace. And then, you got the headlines 20 minutes later said, nope.
Yeah.
So, And the oil like didn't really react to either very much, which both ways is notable. Anyway, S&P closed up just over 1%. NASDAQ 100 closed up 1.1, about 1.3 for small caps. So pretty strong day across the board. Mag 7 doubled up equal weight. So this has turned back into a Mag 7 party. And I think I saw earlier Mag 7 put in a new high against the S&P. Like all-time high. So
today,
yeah, so that percentage of the move there becomes theirs yet again. And
what would that be
left behind?
What would that be attributable? Well, it's probably no. But what I'm saying though is I'm thinking about market caps because none of the significant ones have broken out to new all-time highs. But you had a big pop in Apple. You got Google at or near a new all-time high.
NVIDIA's been ripping
back toward the high end of
the new high, but like ripping, and they're massive market cap.
Does that chart look good again on NVIDIA?
Yeah, it does. Full stop.
And that chart looked like death a week ago.
Yeah. It got it back real quick.
On nothing.
nothing. Yields fairly flat, like down about 3 basis points out on the long end. The rest of it's flat. Oil is mentioned, not really much to report there. Precious metals had a good day. Gold up a little over 1%. And as far as Mag 7 goes, pretty much everything was up except for Apple. Apple down about 1% on the day.
You know, you'd never be able to do this, but I would be so fascinated to know what this market looked like. I bet you could backcast it, but you wouldn't know how it would affect the underlying economy and all the, you know, all the feedback loops and all that kind of stuff. I would just be very curious to know what this market looked like had the whole AI pop not happened.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mental exercise.
Yeah, sure. It is. My suspicion is it wouldn't be anywhere near here.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Yeah, because you know, it's also interesting, too, that we were talking about, sure enough, remember we were talking about last week, if Buffett doesn't sell some Apple,
yeah,
it'll be the biggest head scratcher of all time.
Yeah, sold 13% of his stake.
Yeah, $40 billion. Worth. And he said he had plans to sell. He made some comment about, yeah, we're at $170 billion in cash heading to 200.
Right.
Something like that. I will be shocked.
Some of that's going to come from Apple.
Yeah.
Randy's making 5% on that pile, but.
Because based off the original dividend or whatever.
No, I'm just saying like the T-bill income from $170 billion, like is probably enough to get you pretty close to two by the end of the year. So.
Yeah. 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 Cause it'll be, well, shoot. I mean, yeah, you look at that pie alone. Berkshire did $11 billion in operating profit last year. They can generate $11 billion on their treasury holdings alone this year.
Pretty wild.
That is wild.
You have to do zero work to get that, or you have to do a lot of work to get that operating profit.
Well, and a lot of especially in this, you know, Buffett's in evaluation. He sees the same thing we do. The other interesting thing too, and you, again, you don't want to read into too much, but we know what's driving markets or any, you know, obviously liquidity and deficits and all the stuff that we've talked at length about. It is interesting to I want to get into your construction talk, but it's interesting to me that you're seeing that right at the same time that, now granted, there's some China issues and things like that, but the Apple quarter was even weaker than I would have thought.
Wasn't good.
And Apple has been a bellwether for this economy this entire run. You know? And it kind of reignited the thought in my head of, and I still think that this plays out at some point, that putting the fiscal aside, it's going to be a more complicated economic picture going through, because I think there seems to be this attitude or this belief out there that we've hit this new gear economically. And I just think that you're coming down from the biggest fiscal sugar high of all time. And I think to expect that growth rate and everything to continue going, you've got the deficit spending still there in support, but the hurdles are getting higher and higher. And I just, you know what I mean?
And you see in the earnings commentary, like don't get me wrong. Like we've seen, you could have picked out little things for the last 2 years where it looked like, ooh, like maybe the consumer is starting to slide a little here. Yep. But I felt like this past quarter, and don't get me wrong, earnings were great. Like, that there's nothing wrong with earnings, but in some of the commentary, you just got a little bit more of a bearish vibe about like how consumers are positioned. I mean, Starbucks had a negative, you know, year over year revenue print, like pretty bad. So like
Starbucks and Apple both. And I was thinking, it's funny you bring up Starbucks. I was thinking about both them and Apple, and something's going on. There is weakness here that's not showing up in the numbers.
Yeah, I feel like Apple, you can explain, is China because of the cycle and people re-upping their work for new phones, all that stuff. But
Apple, Starbucks, Nike, though? And Starbucks? Apple, Nike, and Starbucks?
There's some big brands.
If those all three together are coming down at the same time, you cannot sit there and tell me that all is great and the consumer's great. You just can't.
Right.
I'm not saying that.
At the same time, you go look at the airlines and they're like, we keep making like new levels of fake like luxury up and people just keep buying it. Like, so, you know, it does still go both ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well,
19 tiers on an airplane now. Like, well, this one comes with like a metal cup instead of a plastic cup. And you're like, that's an extra 100. And people are like, yeah, I want it.
You know, I the other thing that I was thinking about too is that, when you think about the amount of relocations that occurred because of COVID, you know how stimulative that is, right? We've all moved before. Yeah. You spend money like you're going out, like you're done. Like, you know what I mean? Like
dumb stuff. Like you have to get new trash cans. If you move them. And a lot of people aren't going to move their trash can. Like this,
you eat so out more things, often because stuff's in boxes, right? You got to buy the kids new stuff because it got lost in transit. And you know, they left a switch at an Airbnb that you recently read. Does this sound like I've got personal experience here?
Maybe, yeah.
I keep the tab running while we're on vacation. Wait.
I moved literally all the way across the United States twice in the last 3 years. So
You're right, man.
Went from California to DC to Washington State within 3 years. So trust me, I know the moving pain.
You've literally gone to like the deepest bastions of like wokeness. That's what you've called home in the last three places you've lived, which is funny because that's not who you are at all. But you put that on a resume. Yeah, where have you lived recently? Well, California, D.C., and then Seattle area.
It makes you sound like a coastal elite.
They'd be like, well, I love Biden too, right? Yeah. Anyway, no, but just little, like I said, if you know what's funny is you could pull it up and you could say, I guarantee you it's 08-09. When was the last time that you saw revenue declines for Starbucks, Nike, and Apple at the same time? Anyway, I don't say this conspiratorially, but I continue to believe, you and I were talking about David Rosenberg earlier today, and anybody that's followed David, I respect David's work, but in my opinion, David has not accepted the fact that we just live in a different reality today. And, you know, for 15 years, he's kept pointed to this and this and this. And eventually I started viewing things through the lens of, yeah, David, I agree with you that that's a problem, but it's not a problem that printed money can't fix. And as long as we're dealing with money, the problems that printed money can fix, they're going to get papered over, right? Like, not a big deal. Now, it is in the long run, of course, but that's not the game we're playing, right? So anyway, how does that jive with the – did you go – you haven't walked us through the construction breakdown of the construction jobs, have you?
No. So real quick before I do that, I'll mention data. So incredibly light data week this week, almost nothing. And it's worth noting, very light data weeks tend to be very good weeks for the market. Mm-hmm. So I think good chance we just kind of keep trucking along this week.
And we were – just to remember, we were cautious last week.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be surprised the way the market interpreted the Fed, because I feel like if the Fed speaks and they don't say like, we're going to take your head off, like that's a reason for the market to rally. But it was interesting because, you know, reading that, like if you listen to Powell and you're really operating and you're really operating off of trying to figure out what they're going to do and is it bullish or bearish or whatever, I don't really think there's a lot bullish about that presser. You know what I mean? It's interesting, but that's the market's reaction to it, nonetheless. I mean,
yeah. So the only data that came out today was the SLOOS, the Senior Loan Officer Survey, which is we've talked about it the last, I think, two quarters that we've had it, but it's just the lending standards from banks is again very tight. Again, demand was poor for credit. And I look specifically at construction and multifamily construction, and then like normal, like single family residential, all that tightened up again. So that kind of feeds into what I'm about to talk about with the construction employment side, which is, you know, our main kind of macro focus for now. And we had a 9,000 job, positive job print for construction, which is a pretty big slowdown from recent months. Much, much more importantly, though, if you drill in a little deeper and look at wages and hours worked, that stuff actually pulled back significantly. Not just for outright construction jobs, but the specialty contractors tied to construction jobs, same story. We had, obviously, last week, the JOLTS job openings for construction was the worst month over month print ever. Just the floor just fell out of that, which myself and a lot of other people were like, yeah, but can we trust JOLTS? But then after seeing the non-farm payrolls, not the outright jobs, because that was fine, but the guts of it, I was like, okay, maybe that is real. And then you add to that, so the BLS has a report that no one reads, the BEP that came out last week, and it looks like the next time we do the benchmark revisions for jobs, it will strip out about 90,000 construction jobs.
Dang.
From the third quarter, just one quarter, from positive 55 to negative 35,000 jobs in the third quarter of 2023. Which would suggest, okay, construction is not as healthy as we thought. And
how does that work? Because if you strip them out of that, you got to strip them out of all the reports, right? Like, so for instance,
it's always changing on all of them when they do these benchmark reports. Yeah, it tells you you should probably
pull 90,000 out from this next one.
Tread too carefully for what was also printed in Q4 and Q1, right?
This gets into another point, and I don't want to railroad you. I want you to finish your complete thoughts on this. But this, you and I have spoken about this too. This is why I think every single data point needs to be taken with a massive grain of salt. Things are moving for completely unique historical reasons. Things are moving in magnitudes and speed that they don't normally move. And I think that you could go down the conspiratorial path. Oh, they're cooking the books. I also think that a lot of these metrics were not designed to give you accurate looks in things that are, you know, these things are moving this fast, right? I mean, I just think there's so much chaos and so much of the data just because of the uniqueness of the environment that I just think you have to take all data points with a grain of salt.
Yeah, 100%. And it's all heavily revised. And in most recessions, like, no one has any idea they're in a recession until like virtually a year later, when everyone goes back and they do a bunch of revisions, they're like, oh yeah, by the way, we used to be in a recession. Like, a lot of, there's times where by the time they tell you you were in a recession, you're already out of it. Like,
yeah.
So in that sense, it's like kind of, you know, pointless. Yeah. But So that's why to me, you have to look at everything. You have to look at the change on the margin. And to me, like, I think some people probably see this and be like, why do you even pay attention to this stuff to begin with? Right? Like, who cares? But whenever you look at everything, you can pick up like little notes of change that can turn into feedback loops that become a big deal. So to me, that's why construction is something I do follow closely, is that can become a feedback loop that is felt in the entire economy and can become like the only thing, honestly, it can lead to being the only thing that matters for a 3-year stretch.
The other thing too, is I think we look over, we were talking about how strong the earnings reports were, and on the surface they were. That being said, you only, and I don't know what the long-term number is, but I believe it's slightly, I believe it's a good bit higher than this. One of the things that was interesting is that only 61% of companies that are reported have beat on revenue. And yet
that's above the 10-year average.
Though. Is it above the 10-year average? 10-year
average is 54 and change.
Okay. Percent. Okay. Okay. But it was interesting to me that in this environment, you had a 77% beat on earnings.
Yeah. The earnings beats right now are like through the roof.
Yeah. It's 78.
They're above the 10-year average as well.
Okay. Well, 70 to 80% is usually.
But it's always high.
Yeah, it's always, well, because everybody gained.
Right.
It's not high because they're incredible. It's high because they lower their own bars, right? Exactly. But no, it was interesting to see that, and earnings rates beats are always higher than revenues. But in this environment, exactly, with the inflation factor, I would have just thought the spread between those two would have been a little bit tighter. Yeah, it doesn't mean anything, but just a slight observation I had. Anything else that you saw in the data? Because like I said, I want to be clear. Neither one of us are going, oh, here comes this thing. But like you said, I think it's going to be really of note if construction jobs break, because they always lead. But there's some real people are like, you just said not to put too much data. Yeah, we're not putting it on too much of an indicator. But when you understand the role that they play in the economy, you know what I mean?
It's
they're high paying jobs.
It's incredibly cyclical. Yeah, it is very, very high paying. And especially when you have a cycle where you have more of it than normal, like, and we just did. So like residential construction, not necessarily a whole lot more than normal, but like if you include non-residential and manufacturing construction, like you've never seen this many construction jobs. So if enough of it were to go away at roughly the same time, that's a lot of people out of work. And we do know, like, broadly speaking, the labor market's still fine. Like it's definitely not near as hot as it was a year ago, right?
Yeah.
But it's still fine. But the ability for people to get a job if they lose a job is absolutely eroding, and that is deteriorating. So if all of a sudden, you know, a couple hundred thousand construction workers lose their job and it's not easy to get a new one, like a lot of things change, you know, macro-wise, so for the economy. More than any time in the last year? It looks like that's possible on the construction side. And if you just look at, you know, how many homes are under construction that finally peaked and started the fall, and it's at about a 1 or 2 year low, I can't remember now. So like, it makes sense that you would start to see finally some of these construction jobs like have to go away. So when I look at all of that data together, it tells me that it is very possible that construction has peaked and maybe could, you know, decelerate at a quickening pace moving forward. And that would be a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be, I'd be interested to see what kind of impact that would have. It's going to be, well, interesting is probably not the right word. Recessions are not good and for a lot of folks, and they're hard on a lot of folks, but it's going to be interesting to see with this level of deficit spending, what it actually takes to engender a recession if we get one. Yeah, I mean,
or is a recession just, you know, 0.5% growth for a year and a half or something, you know, like,
yeah, well, that's the other thing is like, you know, if you don't
4.5% unemployment, that's good enough for a recession. Who knows?
Yeah. If you don't see deficits, I mean, it'd be interesting to look back into it. I think it'd be really hard, but go look back at any developed countries that have run deficits in excess of 6% and seeing if you can ever pair that up with, and I'm not talking about once they were already in recession. Right. So like, but I'm saying like, did you go into recession when you were running deficits that hot? And when you start really thinking about it, it's kind of a high bar, right? If you're spending 6.5%, you're like we've said in, you know, the financial crisis, the economy contracted 3.8. Well, you've got 6.5% deficit spending.
That's what's so interesting about the feedback loops on the downside is if construction employment is enough to get the unemployment rate to go to say 4.1, 4.2, and the Fed cuts rates, that the Fed cutting rates in a sense could help lower the deficit by lowering the interest income. It could help lower inflation based on what we talked about as a possibility, at least on Friday, on the Friday show. So you could start a feedback loop, and not to mention you might help the housing market because you remove golden handcuffs from people so that they can actually sell their homes. So you might have all of a sudden a glut of inventory of homes. So you have this weird like deflationary feedback loop where you get lower rates and it leads to more housing supply, which leads to even less construction jobs. This leads to even lower rates and lower inflation and lower deficits.
Which is what we look.
Just basically do the exact opposite of the last 3 years. Just reverse it all, and you could do that for the next couple of years.
And this is what makes me, angry about the trajectory of monetary policy and what central banks have done over the last 15 years, is because you don't have to be a genius or a financial wizard to realize, you know, guys like you and I have been talking about the eventuality, right, the inevitability of ending up in this place where finally you start running down the outcomes and you go, like no matter what. There's going to be pain on one side of it or the other, right? And you talk about all these like easing of inflation. Oh, it could make everything better, but it could also spur a significant down leg in home prices too.
Yeah, which in some ways is wonderful. In some ways,
it's bad. Yeah.
Depends on who you are.
Well, it just goes back to what we've been saying for years, which is what you need is a recession, right? Like you're kind of at one of those points where a recession is actually your friend. But getting back to what we were having, the discussion we were having about interest rates last week, the one caveat you got to remember in there is just, I don't know why they seem to be so recession averse. I don't get it. It would ease all of the issues. They need some defaults. They need private equity to have some defaults. You got to clean some stuff out.
The funny thing is like what I just explained, like, so you could argue. And I'm not saying I'm fully bought in on this, but you could argue that rate cuts would lead to a recession.
Yeah.
So they may end up, you know, chasing their own tail into a recession, which is funny because what we're saying is like, hey, they could really use a recession and like they're fighting against it, but they might accidentally do it to themselves because they don't realize they're doing it to themselves.
Yeah.
The same way that you could argue they got themselves into this, you know, pretty hot situation, without realizing they were doing it to themselves.
This is such a
I'm boring Zach to death, folks.
No, it's more about just almost like mental exhaustion because you're so far. Sometimes I hear us having these conversations and I just you're like, what in the world has happened? You know what I mean? Like listen to us. I mean, this just sounds preposterous.
No,
this is the board you've been given. Yeah. And, you know, and everybody's like, well, that's why nobody can predict the stock market. You just buy and hold. And I'm like, look, man, if that's your approach, great for you. Okay. But as somebody that is a fiduciary of other people's money and that money has to finance the rest of their lives. And looking where we're at historically, we can't take that approach. You gotta be kidding me. Right. Cause what valuation? Like, let's talk about the conditions that company nor you have any control over. And if this condition changes one little bit this way, that company goes from looking fairly priced to exorbitantly overexpensive, right? Like and everybody's like, well, that's always the way it is. No, it's not. This is new, right? For instance, like just even interpreting the business cycle, nobody had it down pat. But there were very reliable signs that if you were paying attention, you were doing the work.
It wasn't that hard back in the day
to figure it out. No, it wasn't hard at all. And it wasn't hard to certainly identify times when you needed to be more cautious and more protected, right? Yeah. But, you know, central banks have come in here and just kind of flipped things on their ears. I also think technology companies have had a lot to do in elongating business cycles and things of that nature. Just because if you look back, and to be fair, if you look back, I think you can probably make a statement that we that our economy here in the United States went through something like a recession in 2011 around the European debt crisis, 2015, 2016, the collapse of the oil fields, things like that. But you didn't get any of the telltale signs. Well, one of the reasons, looking back on it, you didn't get the telltale signs is those tech companies were growing at such a pace and such a magnitude that those little things that traditionally may have caused recessions, they just didn't, because you had this secular growth story going on with the tech companies and the numbers were just so big and so massive. You look back and you're like, what do you mean there's a recession? Earnings were up. And you're like, yeah, it was driven by 10 companies. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So yeah, it's a tough board to look at. What else do we see today? Anything else catch your eye?
No, that's really it.
Pretty tame.
It's gonna be a tame week. Just there's not much data, not much to go off of.
The dollar sure is pricing in cuts. That's a pretty aggressive pullback in the dollar in the last couple of trading days.
Yeah, especially last week in general. But between Jobs and Powell, like, it didn't have much reason to keep going up. But I still think it's possible you could get a few more hot inflation prints this year. And it's pretty obvious at this point, Europe's cutting, you know, a lot of places are going to have to be cutting. And I mean, sure, you can say Powell was dovish vis-a-vis like not going to hike, but he also like made it real clear, like, hey, we're not close to cutting. So you get a couple more hot prints, then he's really not close to cutting. And by then Europe may have cut two or three times, you know?
Yeah.
And that's a tough situation, not to mention, you know, Japan, but that's a tough situation for the dollar really go down sustainably in.
Well, that's why the move I mean, again, it hasn't been like groundbreaking, but that's why the move in the dollar has kind of surprised me a little bit here, just because
when
I'm looking at the dollar, it looks to me like the only way you can really understand the move over the last couple of trading days is it's pricing in more cuts. But the fact that the Fed didn't do anything, I think there's a risk that this pullback in the dollar might be a bit quick.
Yeah, I mean, we went from like 102 to 106 and change, 102 and change to 106 and change over like the last year. Now we've pulled back to 105. It's really not that big a deal at this point.
I thought we were on the way. Last time I looked at today, you had a 104 handle on it.
Yeah, it did the same thing it did Friday and kind of popped back up to that 105, oh, gotcha. 105 line. That 105 line is a big, like,
there's
a
yeah, lot of I thought you, I thought today I looked at it and it looked like it broke the 105 level. Was it 104? And it looked like it was, oh, here we go.
I wouldn't be surprised if it went down to 104 and a quarter or something before it could, you know, get itself together. But I still think it could get itself together. Especially in my opinion, stuff, honestly, against the rest of North America. Like I think against Canada, Mexico, it can have a nice little run higher, but we'll see.
Yeah. Well, what other data do we have coming up this week too?
Or honestly,
nothing.
Pretty much nothing. Nothing like that.
Pretty light.
Is particularly significant. There's some other stuff around the world. We'll have Australian monetary policy. We have some inflation data out of China at the end of the week. So it's not like globally we're starved, but we'll have consumer credit tomorrow in the U.S. That's about it.
I do think it's funny. And we were talking about this last week. I do think it's funny that news came out today or over the weekend that Buffett had dropped what he cut $40 billion off his Apple position.
Yeah, 13%.
Yeah. And he said he's going to be raising more cash. I will be surprised if those sales do not come directly from Apple.
I mean, why wouldn't they? I just don't.
You hear people out there today saying, well, yeah, but it's due to tax. Guys, all of his cap gains are subject to tax.
Yeah, I don't. That's a silly.
No. And when you know Buffett, you've studied Buffett. Like, remember we were just saying, I'm like.
Like you said, Tim Cook was there. Like, what's he going to say? Because I don't like it anymore.
Right. Yeah. No, but, and we don't like the way they're allocating capital. I would love to be a fly on the wall, but if there was any thought that he may not do that or he wasn't going to cut aggressively, from what he said, that buyback might have been the straw that broke the camel's back as far as he's concerned. He's said a lot about running buybacks on expensive stocks. Now he just thinks it's a joke.
It is.
It is. It's burning money.
Allocation, so.
I know. It's just awful. It's burning money. I've never understood it. All righty, man. Well, that's it for today. As always, we'll be back tomorrow. Hopefully you'll keep taking this journey with us, and we'll see where this winding road goes. Until then, you're listening to Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.